We are in the middle of an election year, and we hear from the side not in power of their unhappiness. They are unhappy with the president's response to coronavirus. They are unhappy with his response to the Black Lives Matter movement. They are unhappy with his decision to protect national monuments. Now, in previous years, we saw that people were unhappy with Wall Street, and we had the Occupy Wall Street movement. At that point in time, people were unhappy with their job, they were unhappy with their pay, they were unhappy with corporations, which I thought was ironic that they were unhappy with corporations as they were wearing their Nike shoes and using their Apple iPhones. But that's another story that I digress from. They were unhappy with student loan debt. They're unhappy that they had to pay for health care. They're unhappy that some people have more than they feel they should have in life. Now, I'm simply talking about what's happened perhaps in the last 4 years, but understand and realize that when the other party was in place, the other side of the people in this country were unhappy. So it seems like nobody can be happy. If this person is in power, we're unhappy. If this person makes those decisions, we're unhappy. There was a poll done this year, 2020, by NORC at the University of Chicago, and in that poll, they found that only 14% of those polled in the United States consider themselves to be very happy. Now, think about that for a minute. 14% felt that they were very happy. Now, again, that poll was taken before a lot of the unrest that has occurred since Memorial Day in this nation. We currently live in a time in which unhappiness, or happiness, I guess I could say, seems to be completely subjective. Some people are happy with what they have, regardless of how little that is or how much it is. Some people are happy only when everyone else is as miserable as they are. I'm miserable. And you don't seem to be miserable, therefore, if I can make you miserable, that will make me happy, because then we can all be unhappy, and then I'll be happy. Why is it that so many people have not discovered the key to happiness and peace of mind? Why is it? But let's ask the question not from society today. Let's ask the question about those of us who have been called by God. What about our happiness? What about our happiness? It's easy to look around the world today and say the world is unhappy. But what about us? Are we happy? I'd like to address that in the split sermon, second message this afternoon. And I simply like to ask the question, are you a happy person? Are you a happy person? Now, I've said this before, that my wife is one of the happiest people that I have ever met. She brings me a cup of coffee every morning to wake me up, and she is all good morning and smiles, and I'm like, not until I get coffee, not until I get some caffeine can I be happy. Now, that's actually wrong. I can be happy, but I'm not necessarily ready to ramp it up to her level of happiness until I can get a little caffeine going in the bloodstream. Regardless of what it is, we understand that one thing, when it comes to happiness, it is elusive. It is elusive. But why? Why? People have a tendency to not rule their mind and in turn not rule their emotions. And the end result is actions that are indicative of a person who does not have a controlled mind and the controlled resulting emotions. 82 nights in downtown Portland have led me to believe there are a lot of people that cannot rule their mind, and in turn, they cannot rule their emotions. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. It's also interesting to note that when it comes to unhappiness, studies have been shown, again, to show that there is a correlation between one's physical health and upset of human emotions or unhappiness. You can think about that from the standpoint of when you get bad news. When you get really, really bad news, your stomach churns. You begin to feel ill. You probably know, and I know from my standpoint, when I, again, got our house phone and I've got my cell phone, it's always right there on my nightstand, and I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning. And before I've even answered the call, my stomach is churning because nobody's calling me at 2 in the morning and say, hey, how's it going? It's bad news, right? So before I even answer the phone, I know right away something's happening here. My physical system begins to be affected by what happens and what occurs. I remember last feast, just before we began the opening night of services in Spokane, I got some bad news. I remember it so vividly because I was so upset. I was literally ready to throw up. I wanted to go into the corner. I'm there at the hotel. I'm thinking, can I find a corner somewhere where I can throw up? Where's the bathroom? I don't think I can make it to the bathroom. I'm going to throw up. But you get my point. Something happens, and this unhappiness causes a situation where we simply get physically ill. Medical scientists have concluded that there are dozens of body ills that are tied to an upset of human emotions. But you know what? We didn't need medical scientists to figure that out. About 3,000 years ago, there was a proverb that had it figured out for us. Turn with me over to Proverbs chapter 17. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 22. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 22. Proverbs chapter 17 and notice verse 22. He says, a merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. Dries the bones. You get this image again of a person with dried up bones. That you get the same situation. You've ever been camping and you're looking for that kindling. And so you're looking for the driest sticks you can find. And you find those sticks, you know, they're a little too big and you crack them and crack. You get this dryness to the sticks. The same situation of the bones that when you have this broken spirit, this unhappiness, it just literally dries the bones and it causes this illness, this way of thinking that permeates our entire physical body, and we ache and we feel lousy. Again, the understanding of happiness and how it affects us physically. We as a people have to come back to an understanding that we have to learn to be satisfied. You know, back in the 1970s, the rock band The Rolling Stones sang a song that was entitled, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. If you had wasted youth like I did, you remember that song. You listen to it. So we drive home, like tonight we'll drive home and I'll have Classic Rewind on Sirius XM satellite and I'll go through 2.5 hours and tell my wife all these songs 30 seconds into them. She says, how do you know all this? I said, wasted youth, honey. Wasted youth. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, but I can name all these songs in the first 30 seconds. But again, back in the 70s, the Rolling Stones had that song, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And that seems to be a moniker of so many in the world today. They just can't get no satisfaction. But we come to understand that satisfaction is something that must be learned. Satisfaction is something that must be learned. It cannot just be the acquiring of money and stuff. There's a lot of people that have more money and stuff than all of us in this room combined. But if you were to talk to them, I guarantee you they would tell you, they're not happy. They're not happy. Notice over in Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 13, he says, a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by the sorrow of the heart, the spirit is broken. So here we find again the Proverbs that are often written with a contrasting statement. If you have the merry heart, it says there in verse 13, it makes a cheerful countenance, but if there's sorrow. So if we have happiness, it creates a situation of a cheerful countenance. But if you're unhappy, it's just the spirit is broken. It does not tell us that the merry heart here has to have stuff in order to be merry. A merry heart can be merry for a number of reasons, but ultimately it comes down to one thing. It is a choice. It is a choice in terms of dealing with happiness. Emotional brooding and worrying over things we have no control over will rob us of happiness. We can brood and worry, and our outlook becomes negative. And left in that condition, our spirit can be broken. Now, again, I'm not saying that there won't be things that happen and occur, and we need to be happy about it. We can go through a trial and a difficulty and say, well, I'm happy about this. You know, as James said, count it all joy when you fall into trials. Well, that can be difficult at the moment and the instant we go through it. But as we begin to analyze it, as we begin to think about it, as we begin to realize what we're learning as an end result of what we're going through, there can be an element there of happiness that we say, okay, I got to go through this. I don't like this, but I'm going to make it through it. The point being here is when we brood on it, when we worry about it, when we have this constant negative outlook about it, this unhappiness about it, that is when left in that condition, our spirit is broken. Notice verse 15 of this same chapter, Proverbs 15, verse 15. He says, all the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. Man, oh man, it's steak and baked potato every day, and you don't have to worry about your cholesterol. Nobody's telling you to eat the green stuff. You know, you don't have to worry about salads and eat your vegetables. No, don't need to worry about it. Dessert every day. It's a feast every day. Again, a merry heart. You know, it's interesting that in spite of all our blessings in the Western world, many of us still find it hard to be happy. Why is that? You know, we think about just the little things. And again, I focus on that. You've heard me say it before. There is tremendous benefits and blessings that we have been granted in the Western world that members in far-flung areas of the country or the world do not have. We had the ability that I don't think any of us here had to walk 5 miles to services and have a five-mile walk back home. We were able to put on nice clothes for services today. We can go back home. We can turn on the tap and we can have clean, clear, cold water. It's a little cool tonight. We can turn on the heat. If it's too hot tomorrow, we can turn on the air conditioning. We have all these benefits. We have all these blessings. But again, we tend to think about the things that we don't have and then we are unhappy. We have to learn to be grateful and thankful for what we have. But again, we as descendants of ancient Israelites love to complain. We love to complain about what we do not have. We want more. We are not satisfied with what we have. These are the things that we have to contend with when it comes to happiness and truly being a happy person. Notice over in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, and let's begin here in verse 10. Philippians chapter 4, and notice beginning in verse 10, he says, but I rejoice, the Apostle Paul speaking here, but I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. That's an important statement. He says, I have learned. As you look at the Apostle Paul's life, you understand that he went through some tremendous challenges. So he had to learn this. But what did he learn? Did he learn to be unhappy with what he did have or did not have? No. He says, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. Verse 12, I know how to be abased and I know how to abound everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Now, let me remind you of what you already know. This is Philippians chapter 4. The book of Philippians is one of the prison epistles that he was writing. So he is writing this. He is writing this to the church as he is imprisoned, probably chained to a soldier with another one standing guard over him. He is under house arrest. And he's making the statement. He says, you know what? He says, whatever condition I'm in, I've learned to deal with it. I've learned to be content, even if it means I've got to be imprisoned, even if it means I have to be chained to this Roman soldier, even if it means I'm writing this and I see this other guy standing there with his sword and his shield. He had learned something. Human beings have to learn to be content. Paul had to learn in whatever condition he was to be content. Notice the passage of Scripture over in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Let's begin in verse 23. Here, Paul is again talking about ministers, and there are those that they're questioning again certain things with regards to his ministry, and he starts talking about other individuals, and then they start talking about others, and in verse 22 he talks about the Hebrews, Israelites, those that he talks about to speak boldly, and others did not speak boldly. Sometimes they challenge Paul in terms of the fact that, you know, his letters are strong, but when he speaks he just appears kind of weak. And so he starts addressing some of these things, and he starts in the middle of addressing these things and whether he truly is an apostle of God, he begins to talk about some of the things that he had gone through, and he sort of capsulizes it. You know, he sort of gives it's, you know, you think about the old Spokesman's Club, this 6-minute icebreaker. He was going through his life in 6 minutes, but here he's going to deal with it in about 3 or 4 verses. Notice in verse 23. He says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. In other words, I've been beaten 5 times. You want to compare? You want to talk about these peoples and their sufferings? Verse 25, 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils of the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils of the sea, in perils among false brethren. In other words, there's nowhere I could go and no one I could come in contact with that I wasn't dealing with problems. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. So I said, you want to start talking about problems and all these things you're going through? Here's my life for you, sort of in a capsulized 30-second statement. And then on top of all these things, my sleepless nights over the daily concern for the churches. And yet, in spite of all that, remember what we read back in Philippians 4. He says, whatever place I have been in, I have had to learn how to be content. I have had to learn when I was shipwrecked. I've had to learn to be content. When I went through these perils with my countrymen, with the Gentiles, I've had to learn to be content. I've had to learn these things. The point being that Paul had to go through a lot, but he learned contentment through it all. He learned contentment through it all. So let's ask the question. I asked the question earlier, are you a happy person? You have to answer that for yourself. I have to answer that for myself. But let's ask the question now and answer it. How can we be a happy person? If this is an area that we need to work on, if this is an area that we say, well, I think I'm a happy person, but maybe I could elevate it a couple more levels. Maybe I could enhance it. Maybe I could build it. Maybe I could grow upon what I already have. How can we do that? Well, let me give you a few points in the remainder of the sermon that will help with regards to answering that question, how we can be a happy person. Point number one, accentuate the positive and practice cheerfulness. Accentuate the positive and practice cheerfulness. Do you know how easy the negative is? The negative is so easy, you don't even have to think about it. You know, I remember way back when, my days in Spokesman's Club and Ambassador Club when I was in Ambassador College, And you got that 6-minute speech. I know some of you probably were in Spokesman's Club. And you remember that after that, you sat down, and now for your evaluation, Mr. So-and-so. And so he's got the 2-minute evaluation. Yeah, I can remember that 6-minute speech, and I can remember evaluating speeches, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I can come up with a dozen things that this guy did wrong in his speaking. I can think of every negative thing you did wrong. You used your hands too much. You didn't use your hands enough. You spoke too loud. You spoke too soft. You had no vocal variety. You had too much vocal variety. You had no point. You had this. You had that, whatever it might be. You can always come up with the negative. But again, being able to find that positive in any situation. I remember when I would evaluate someone. And basically what I would take from that particular speech is the things that they really did well, that the positives that I saw in that 6-minute speech. I say, this is what you really did well. This is also what you really did well. And you did this well as well. So let me give you one point that I think that if you worked on that one point, it would even enhance your speech and make it that much better than it was. And give them that one point. So you accentuate the positive and you bring across something. You say, you know what? If you dealt with this, you could be a better speaker. Yes, I know if I spoke slower, I'd be a better speaker, but you'll have to deal with that. Listen slower. My point being here is that it's always easier to see the negative, but we need to accentuate the positive. I've often found in my own personal life and talking to people that people who are constantly negative are also the ones that are more prone to physical ailments. Have you ever noticed that? The person that, now I'm not saying that just because someone has a physical ailment that automatically they're a negative person. I'm not saying that. But when you're dealing with somebody sometimes, and I've often seen when they've got very serious problems, it weighs them down to the point where they're just not only negative about their physical health, but everything else in life is just weighing them down. Everything is just a negative person. The cheerful, happy person seems to be healthier. You can ask two people. You can ask two people on a day where there's clouds in the sky and there's also sun. Is it partly cloudy or is it partly sunny? The happy person will say, it's partly sunny. The negative person will say, it's partly cloudy. Can't have a day with just nothing but a blue sky. We got to have these clouds. The other person says, well, you know, there's a few clouds, but I'm really glad the sun's out. It's accentuating the positive and practicing cheerfulness. Notice over in Philippians chapter 4. Let's go to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. And notice verse 4. Paul says here, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Now again, as I already stated, remember, he's writing this epistle as he is in prison, as he is chained. Let's drop down to verse 8. He says, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Why? Because those are the things that make for happiness. Right now, there seems to be a lot of a thought process over what we do not have. So we have to learn to harness the mind. We have to learn to harness the mind, accentuating the positive. It does not mean being a Pollyanna. You ever saw that movie? I think the actress was Haley Mills. It's not being a Pollyanna. It doesn't mean being excessively cheerful and overly optimistic. It doesn't mean if somebody takes a baseball bat and hits you across the forehead, you go, oh, that was great, do it again. That's stupid. What we're talking about is looking at something and thinking of it from the standpoint of a positive, cheerful, realistic, from that particular standpoint. Let's move on to number two. Second way that we can be happy, you've heard the expression before, don't cry over spilled milk. Don't cry over spilled milk. It's just simply a famous saying that tells us that we cannot change the past. And if you cannot change the past, what good does it do to dwell on it and brood over it? You spill the milk, it's on the floor, you can't put it back in the container. Even if you could, who's going to drink that milk after it's been on the ground? You can't put the milk back in the container. So what's happened in the past has happened in the past. We all have past frustrations. We all have misfortunes that have come our way, or we have faced defeats of one form or another. We cannot change those things. We cannot change those things. However, what we can change is our attitude towards those things. That is what we can change. Notice over in Philippians chapter 3. Actually, we're right here, Philippians chapter 3. Let's begin in verse 13. He says, "Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." Remember shipwrecked? Remember dealing with everybody? Nobody liked him. Everybody was having a problem with Paul. All of these things, being beaten. Beaten five times, less one by the Jews, over and over and over again, imprisoned. But he says, "I'm not looking back at that. I can't change that. My trajectory has got to be upwards and forward to the calling to the kingdom of God." You know, many years ago, there was a movie, maybe some of you saw it, called Gumball Rally. The story of a couple of individuals, and they were really rather well-to-do individuals, and so they would have this race across the country from New York City to Los Angeles, and it was just this group of individuals get together, and they just do this race across the nation, and it was called the Gumball Rally. I mean, they were so rich, I think at the end of it, you actually got a gumball machine with gumballs in it. That's what it amounted to. And so you had these two particular individuals in this movie that were constantly at battle with each other because they were the best drivers. So they're always looking for the advantage. And so this one individual decided he was going to get it over on his rival. And so he hired this Italian driver. Best kind of driver, Italian, right? You know that. They had the best cars, they had the best drivers. I'm a little bit biased on that, but anyways. So he gets this Italian driver. And the guy sits in his sports car, and the guy sits on the other side. The Italian driver sits in the driver's seat. And the first thing he does is he takes the rear view mirror off the windshield, and he takes it out and he throws it out the window. And the guy says, "What'd you do that for?" "Well, what was behind me is not important." So his point was, I don't care what's behind me. I only care about making it to Los Angeles. We're going to win this race. What's behind us, again, is not important. It is important from the standpoint that it may have shaped us, but it does not need to be a situation that takes us down a notch or decides to slow us down from the growth that God has in mind for us. We learn lessons from the past. There's no question about that. Everything that Paul went through that we read back in 2 Corinthians, he learned from those things. No question about it. But he didn't dwell on it. He did not dwell on it. He did not look backwards. Again, we can go back to the standpoint of looking at each day with a clean slate. Start the day fresh. Let the frustrations, let the misfortunes, let the defeats just evaporate away. Now again, sometimes that can take some time. I get that. That's the human side. Human emotions get in. But we decide whether we're going to rule that mind and whether we're going to let those defeats, those misfortunes, those frustrations eat away at us. We decide whether we're going to do that. Point number three. Always put that in all caps if you're taking notes, and underline it. Always avoid bickering and arguments. The unhappy person is always bickering and they are always arguing. Always avoid bickering and arguments. Brethren, they are a total waste of energy. Have you ever argued with someone? I mean, just, I'm talking about a toe-to-toe verbal battle. How did you feel at the end of it? You know how I felt at the end of it? I felt like I'd just gone 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali. I'm worn out. You know, sometimes you get in a situation where you, years and years and years ago, I remember this is back probably in the 90s when we were coming out of the Worldwide Church of God, you get in these chat rooms. That was the, before we have everything we have today with social media and whatnot, you had these chat rooms. So you enter in these chat rooms and people in there and they're talking stuff and it's just back and forth, back and forth. It's total and complete chaos. I can remember being in there and I thought I'd been in there for like 4 hours. And I look, it's like 20 minutes. It just wears you out because they're just arguing and bickering and fighting. It is a waste of energy. Trying to convince an inconvincible person is like trying to go west here to the ocean and hold back the tide. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Sadly, this is what we see today with politics, with the coronavirus. People want to argue, they want to bicker, and they want to fight. And I was like, why? How is that going to bring any happiness into your life? It won't. It won't. Notice 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. And let's notice verse 14. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 14. Paul speaking to Timothy here, he says, remind them of these things, charging them before the Lord not to strive about words to no profit, to the ruin of the hearers. Now, again, he's talking from the standpoint, from the scriptural standpoint of spiritual things, but I would simply submit to you that that can be any type of words that's of no profit. What is the point of bickering? What is the point of arguing? As he says, it does not do anything for you. Drop down to verse 23. He says, but avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. Oh, how true he is. How true he is. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient. Now you look at that and you say, well, that he's speaking to Timothy. He's a young evangelist. So, Mr. Pennelly, that's for you. Well, we're all going to be servants. We're all going to have the opportunity. And we must learn these things now, not to quarrel, but to be gentle to all. We are all representatives of the faith of God. We are, again, representatives of an individual living with Jesus Christ, living in them. And so we should have the ability at any particular moment given in time to be able to explain what we do in what? Such a way that we are not quarreling with someone. We're gentle to them. We are teaching them. We are patient with them. We all have opportunity to do that. But again, I find it interesting that he keeps going back to this same thing about avoiding foolish disputes, avoiding quarrelsome words, avoiding empty words, these things that just, again, bickering and arguments is all they bring about. None of the times, you can go to the gospel accounts, you don't see any time that Jesus Christ was bickering and arguing with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They would ask him a question, he would answer it. They didn't like it because they didn't have a comeback. But when they wanted to come back at him, he just walked away. No, I'm done here. I'm done. You asked me a question, I answered it. I'm moving away. Yeah, but. Where'd he go? He wasn't going to argue. He wasn't going to get into a foolish dispute. So again, I've always avoided the bickering arguments. This just robs us of the happiness in our lives. Number four. Face and handle our problems with big-mindedness, faith, and courage. And that's a big one. Let me repeat it. Face and handle our problems with big-mindedness, faith, and courage. What does it mean to be big-minded? Well, it's synonymous with the term seeing the big picture. You've heard that before? Many people see the world through the peephole of a door. If you've got a peephole at home, you know that you put your eye up against the thing, you peer through the peephole, and what do you see? You see the person that's knocking on your door that rang your doorbell, and maybe you see out, several feet in either direction, 5-6 feet in either direction. That's all you see. You can't see anything else. Open the door, and what happens? You can see more. If it's in a hallway, you can see down either side of the hallway, or if it's outside, you can see the street in front of you. Get up on top of your roof, and you probably can see the neighborhood around where you're at. Get up into a plane and look down from 30,000 feet, and you can see the whole city, you can see the whole town, and you can see the whole state. But think about what God sees as he sits on his throne. He sees the universe, does he not? He sees the universe. So when we look at something, we need to look at it from the standpoint of a big-mindedness. When we look at problems from a big-mindedness, they become very, very small. When we do it that way, our problems, we can tend to control then our mind and our emotions. Notice over in Proverbs chapter 16. Again, we simply say that this is perspective. Don't take the peephole view. Take the throne room view. See it from the standpoint of the universe and not from the peephole in the door that sees about 3 feet in either direction. Proverbs chapter 16, and notice verse 32. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. How do you rule your spirit? Well, you have to rule your mind. When we are able to rule our mind, then our emotions do not get the best of us. When emotions get the best of us, we lose control, and we are therefore, in turn, not ruling our mind. Now, again, the statement was, look at these things from big-mindedness and faith and courage. So where do faith and courage come in? We saw how big-mindedness and looking at a particular problem from a larger view, how do faith and courage then come in? Well, they're closely connected. Because when we have big-mindedness, it helps to build our faith. And then with this faith, we have the courage to deal with any problem that might come at us. The courage to step forward, we have the ability to do that when we understand the bigger picture of something and we have faith in God that he will see us through. When we look at it from that standpoint, we can have a happiness or a happy outlook on whatever we're having to deal with. Point number five, which kind of goes along with the last one, number four, is build faith in God. Build faith in God. The strong in faith are always also very happy people. How can I know that? How do I prove that statement? I will simply tell you that in my history in the church, 50 plus years, the happiest people I have seen have also been the most faithful people. And those that have been strong in the faith, by extension, are also very happy. It just goes both ways. It just goes both ways. If we find ourselves being unhappy, is it possible that our faith is lacking? That's a question we have to ask ourselves. A faithful person learns to take God at his word. They do not doubt what he says. So when they read, he says he will do the following, they feed on that promise. It's like running to the trough for a cold drink of water. Well, we don't go to the trough, I guess horse does, but running to the sink or running to the tap for a cold drink of water, right? When you get that cold drink of water, again, we feed on that. You've been so thirsty, I'm so thirsty, I'm so dry, I'm parched. And you get that water, it's like, oh, tastes so good. I mean, it's just water. Same is true of God's promises. We don't doubt it. We have faith in it. And then when we read that, we feed on that. And when we see it happen in our lives, we build our faith. We take God at his word, we learn to obey him, and then trust that he will deliver from any trial or test. The formula, if you're a mathematician, the formula is that simple. It is that simple. A plus B equals C. We take God at his word, that's A. We learn to obey him. That's B. What does it equal? We trust that he will deliver us from any trial or test. Simple mathematical formula. Notice over in Proverbs chapter 14. Proverbs chapter 14, and notice verse 26. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 26. He says, in the fear of the Lord there is strong confidence, and his children will have a place of refuge. Strong confidence. Not only is it something that is good for us, it makes us happy, it will make our children happy, it will make our families happy. Let's notice over in Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 23. Proverbs 19 and verse 23. One more scripture in this particular point. Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 23. He says, the fear of the Lord leads to life, and he who has it will abide in satisfaction. He will not be visited with evil. In other words, fear being a deep, moving, and abiding respect for God. In other words, we believe him when he says, I will do this for you. That should make us happy. When God says, I will protect you, I will provide for you, I will take care of you, I am your shield, I am your fortress. Oh, that makes me happy. That means I don't have to fear when I go to bed at night. That means I don't have to fear that these things that happen around me, again, understanding, realizing I'm not going to put myself in a difficult situation, but God is going to be there to protect me. I'm happy about that. I'm happy about that. Let's move on to the last point, number six. Very simply, be a doer. The be a doer. This point is simply the essence of us being responsible for our happiness. I can sit here and I can preach for you as I have for the last 41 minutes and 53 seconds. I know that because that's what my timer says. But it means nothing if you've only heard it and we're not going to do it. We have to be proactive in our approach. And I speak these words to myself as much as to you. Information is useless without putting it into practice. If I don't do these things, then I am just as guilty of being unhappy as well. Information. The Word of God. Information is useless without putting it into practice. The Word of God is no different. We can memorize the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. Memorize it. But unless we put it into practice, we get no closer to the goal of happiness. Romans chapter 2 and verse 13. Go over there for a moment. Romans chapter 2 and verse 13. Romans chapter 2 and verse 13. Romans chapter 2, verse 13, he says, For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. We cannot just know it in the head. We cannot just know it in the heart. We have to live it daily to be a doer of the law. When we are a doer of the law, we will find happiness. When we are a doer, we will find happiness. Let's look over at John chapter 10. John chapter 10 and verse 10. John 10 and verse 10. Jesus Christ speaking about the thief. We know that ultimately Satan is what? He is the thief. He is the one that robs and takes happiness from an individual. But they choose that unhappiness. Jesus Christ makes a statement here in verse 10 of chapter 10, which is most important for us. Notice what he says. He says, the thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and they may have it more abundantly. Now, if we can't read that and recognize and realize that that means a happy life, then we're missing something, aren't we? Jesus Christ came so that we would have a more abundant life. The abundant life is a happy life. Doesn't necessarily mean that we have an abundance in terms of money and stuff and goods and things. We have an abundant life from understanding what we have been called to be a part of. That's an abundant life. The way of happiness is only found through what? Following the practices and the teachings of Jesus Christ and living it daily. Let's conclude by turning over to Psalm chapter 16. Are we a happy person? We have to answer that question for ourselves. In any moment in time, I realize and recognize that some of us may let down and we may have unhappiness, but does it linger? Or can we say that overall, I'm a happy person? I'm part of the family of God. I understand the plan of God. I understand I've been called to be a part of it. I understand that all this chaos and this unmitigated sin and misery that exists on the face of the earth and the planet will come to nothing. I'm happy about that. I'm happy that the knowledge and understanding that I have is going to be given to all mankind to understand at some point in the future. I'm happy about that. Psalm chapter 16 and verse 11. He says, "You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy." Happiness. "In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forever." There is an abundance, brethren, of unhappiness in the world today. Are we a person that is part of that unhappiness? And if we are, why? Why? God has given us an abundant life. Therefore, let us live our lives in true happiness because of this abundant life.